what was your role here?
I came here in 1966 after a year at Woomera. I came here as an analog instrumentation technician, and I stayed here for 11 years. Left in late 1977. I was involved in the commissioning of this thing, the big antenna, mainly in fitting it out when it was built, cabling and the like, which was fairly strenuous work, fairly dirty work in some places too, because there's a tunnel that links the operations building to the base of the antenna, through which all the cables run, and it was quite a dark and damp place to work in those days.
And a bit like putting in the NBN fibre optics now.
I think they get it a bit easier these days.
Yes.
So it was all very exciting stuff. And during the Apollo missions, before this was constructed, we used to go up to Parkes. A team of us used to go to the Parkes Radio Telescope just for a six-week period around the Apollo mission time. And we'd spend a couple of weeks commissioning our equipment up there, and then a couple of weeks of mission time, and then the following week or 2 weeks decommissioning again to come back here. So for each Apollo mission up until 17, I think, was the first one, was done here, but all the others were done at Parkes. So it was a very, very busy time, very exciting time, and I'm so thankful to have been a part of it. I just loved every minute. It was really great.
So what else did you do during your career?
When I left here?
Well, before then? Yeah.
Oh, before I came, before I went to Woomera, I was in the Royal Air Force. I was a radar technician. I left the Royal Air Force in 64, came to Australia in 65. Worked for a year at Woomera and then 11 years here. And then I went to the University of Queensland, where I worked the rest of my working life. Retired at age 55, and I now live at Noosa on the Sunshine Coast.
Oh, wonderful. So it must bring back a lot of memories to be here today.
It certainly does, yes. This is the second time we've been back to one of these functions. That we came back for the Apollo 11 40th anniversary in 2009. So this is the second time I've been back. It's the first time I've been out here since I left it. So, very interesting.
Any particular missions come to mind? Were you involved in those, or were you sort of on the sidelines when they happened, having done the technical work?
Well, most people have probably forgotten the missions I was involved in. When I first came here, we were doing Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11.
Pioneer 11, just a few days ago, had its 40th anniversary of its launch.
Yes, that's right, but we were still up in Queensland, so we didn't get to hear about any celebrations for that. But, and Mariner missions, the early Mariner missions we did. Mars.
The Mariner, yes.
Yeah, Mariner, Mars, and Venus too, the Venus missions. Viking had been launched, it was about to be launched, I think, when I left here. I'm not quite sure of the facts there, but
I think it was launched 75, landed in July 76, if I remember correctly.
Yes. So, yeah, there's a few that I can remember. And, of course, the Surveyor missions, who could forget those? And we did all of those here, but not with 43, with 42. And the first unmanned landings, soft landings on the moon, which was quite fascinating. And Colin McKellar has actually got quite a lot of material that I gave him, photographs and things that we took here at the time of recording them. So they're on the Honeysuckle website if anybody's interested.
Yes. Were you surprised that the Viking landers operated on Mars for so long?
I think everyone was. I don't think they were expected to last very long at all, but they didn't. We didn't know very much about the environment on Mars. I mean, they really were pathfinders, and it's probably not such a great surprise now to know that they survived for such a long time.
Yes, of course, Spirit and Opportunity lasted a long time, and Opportunity is still going.
That's right, exactly. Yes, and well, thanks to you know, previous missions that told us a bit about what they'd have to encounter up there. So very helpful.
Now, how essential is Tidbinbilla to the overall worldwide tracking of mainly American spacecraft?
Well, it is absolutely essential because they have to have 24-hour coverage, and because they're equally spaced around the world, they can get 24-hour coverage. Without this station, they'd be missing a slab.
So the other stations are at Goldstone?
Goldstone and Madrid.
Yeah, Goldstone being just out of Los Angeles.
Yep.
And that pretty much puts them 120 degrees apart?
Approximately, yes, that's right. So,
Presumably, while you're tracking one spacecraft in one direction, another planet's in another direction, and you're tracking another spacecraft in Goldstone?
That happens, yes. In fact, we supported multiple missions here from time to time, yeah. And, of course, they do now all of the time because they've got several antennas and they can really... they can cover a lot of things, and I don't think these days, I'm not absolutely sure about it, but I don't think they track from the over the horizon to going back over the horizon. I think they do bits of it, yes. And they switch between missions that way. We used to acquire a spacecraft on the horizon as it rose and track it all the way across the sky until it set. And of course, with something like Apollo, well, you've got to have the 24-hour coverage. That's the only way you can do it.
Yes.
But some of the other missions, like Pioneer, and they're not doing anything particular. You know, they're just sending back constant data and no big significant events for long periods of time. Probably not necessary to track them all of the time. I don't know. I'm just supposing, but I would suggest that that's probably what they do.
Now, when you say you track them from horizon to horizon, from when a planet rises to when it sets, it'd be about 10 hours or so?
Yes, it would be. I'm not sure what the actual tracking time here be. I'd say probably be about 10 hours, yes.
And people might be familiar with the International Space Station going from horizon to horizon in 6 or 7 minutes.
Yes.
But that's something totally different.
Yes. Oh, well, I mean, to all intents and purposes, when you're tracking spacecraft like Viking and Pioneers and Cassini and the ones that are a long way out, you really just focus on a spot in the sky. And as the Earth rotates, you... compensate for that with sidereal drive.
They don't move much relative to the stars.
You wouldn't notice any if you could see them. No, that's right.
And what's perhaps been your highlight here?
Oh, that's a good question. There were so many highlights, and it's really difficult to rank them. I can give you some examples of real highlights, and of course. The first one that I can remember, which was astonishing, was when the first surveyor landed softly on the moon and returned data and photographs. To me, that was just sublime. It was absolutely unreal. So I really loved that. And, of course, it goes without saying, Apollo 11, likewise. But also, you know, with the soft landings on Mars, too, they didn't have quite the same intensity because the lunar stuff... You had it within a few seconds of it happening, you had it back here. At Mars, I think it was something like 40 minutes after the event that we got the signal back here. It was a long time anyway, maybe not 40 minutes, but it wasn't sort of instant like Apollo and Surveyor. But I can truly say that I was astonished when the first Surveyor landed softly on the moon. It probably was the first really significant highlight for me. And then there were lots of others, as I say, Apollo 11 and subsequent Apollos too, because they have you holding your breath on the way down. And
it must be pretty exciting to know that an antenna is pointing out at a spacecraft which is leaving the solar system.
Yes.
As the Pioneer 10 and 11 did, of course we're not tracking them anymore, and Voyagers 1 and 2, and now of course New Horizons.
Yes, that's right, going out and going into interstellar space. That's almost beyond my comprehension. Such a long way away. Well, the signal strength that they're getting back now is so tiny too.
So I'll just pause for a moment there. I'm getting a bit of wind from the current.
The signal strengths that they're working with now, I don't know what sort of thresholds they have on the receiving equipment these days, but they are receiving such minute signals from such a long, long way away. That in itself is absolutely remarkable to me.
Yes. So what would be the power of a transmitter on, say, Voyager, approximately?
Well, I don't know. I think they're only about 5 watts or 6 watts. They're very, very small transmitter power.
Yeah. So if it were light, which of course it's not radio waves, but if it were light, imagine a 5-watt light bulb Here on Earth, if it's on the hill over here, just a kilometre away,
you'd barely see it.
You wouldn't be able to see it.
You'd barely see it, that's right, exactly. I know.
And yet something just with that power, yes. We can see, in radio terms.
You liken it to a light bulb which emits light in all directions. Mm. These spacecraft are up there with very high gain dish antennas, and they point it back here in a beam, which is exactly what we do when we receive it from this thing. It's a beam.
Okay,
it's a very narrow beam and a very high gain, so...
So we've got a 5-watt torch with a parabolic mirror behind it.
Yeah.
You're still not going to see it.
Well, yeah, I know it is. It's remarkable, truly.
It's remarkable. Yeah. And so how big is this dish we're standing beside here?
This is now 70 metres in diameter. When I was here and when it was built, it was a 64-metre diameter. They've widened it a little bit, which doesn't seem very much. But it's on the outside of the antenna, of course, so the area that they've added to it is really quite good, quite big.
Mm. So. Perhaps you could trace for us, because you're more familiar with the cabling and so on. We've got a parabolic dish in front of us here. At the moment it's pointing straight up in the sky because it's being serviced.
Yes.
Signal comes down, hits that parabola. Where does it go from there?
It hits the dish surface. It is then focused onto that dome that you see at the top of the quad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which refocuses it down into the receiver. Okay, so and it's what's known as a Cassegrain system. So everything that comes straight into that dish gets reflected back up there, and it gets focused down into the waveguide and down into the receiver. And I'm not quite sure what kind of receivers they use now, but when I worked here, the front end were masers,
microwave equivalent of lasers.
Yes, that's right. And they were run cryogenically and therefore had very little introduced noise and quite big gain. So you could take a tiny signal and amplify it and not add any of your own noise to it.
Cryogenic being with liquid nitrogen?
Liquid nitrogen, yeah.
Okay. And then where did the signal go from there?
From there, come down from the preamps up there, down to the receivers, which are in the operations building, where it would be further amplified and processed, and then the data would be stripped from it. Some of it put back into space to go to be transmitted directly back to JPL. Some of it to be recorded here on the ground. Generally speaking, I don't know really what they do here now, but in our day, most of the data that we received was actually recorded here and then shipped back to the USA, because there would be far more data than you could actually transmit via landlines, you know, in the time available.
Yes.
And so you would transmit back vital data. TV, you could only... It was relatively low scan, a very low definition, but the best we could do to send that live. And even that was, you know, for the time, it was quite advanced stuff. Now, of course, they can do it in high definition, digital, and it's super duper. But we did things very much more basically. As was pointed out this morning, you know, the technology that's come online since this was built, most of it's become redundant. I mean, it lasts a couple of years and it's gone. This is becoming more and more relevant because it's uncovering much more knowledge, and it's never going to be redundant. It's almost going to be able to do what it does. So it's amazing, yeah.
As long as you keep painting it and keep the rust away.
Yeah. Can you imagine painting that? Yeah, it's a big job. Yes. It's astonishing too. There's 3,000 tons of superstructure on that thing, floating on a film of oil.
Floating
on a film of oil. The bearing that it rotates on is steel plates with a film of oil between them, which is pumped in under pressure, and that gives it a very, very low friction bearing to move on. Keeps it very smooth, and that's how that's supported.
So, exaggerating a bit, but if I go up there and push it with my little finger, it would start spinning around?
Oh, given that if you were in a vacuum with no wind and... yeah, it has a lot of inertia, but no, very low friction and, yeah, very smooth. I believe part of what they're doing to it at the moment, I think I read on the net a week or two ago, was they're actually repacking the grout underneath that bearing. So, presumably it's deteriorated and needs to be redone, so... Mm.
well, 40 years ago.
Years, a long time, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. For any structure.
Yeah. One time, well, I can't remember the year, but it would have been probably in the early 70s, and we were on a graveyard shift, and we were tracking, and we were using 43, and we had an earth tremor here. It wasn't directly here, it was, I think, out near Gunning somewhere, and I think it was, from memory, about 4.5 on the Richter scale, but we felt it shake here. All the equipment in the operations room and the floor shook, and we lost contact with a spacecraft because that also shook. And it's such a narrow beam width with a tiny shake, and you've lost it. And and we then had to research around in that general area to re-find the spacecraft.
Yes, someone told me this morning that it was the beam width, I think, is 1/10,000th of a degree. Yeah. Seems incredibly tiny.
Yeah, that's right. It's very, very small, isn't it? So, any disturbance to that at all, and you're just going to lose it.
Yeah, I mean, if it's that tiny, I sort of wonder if I go alongside and jump up and down, whether or not it off course.
I doubt it. Not 3,000 tons. No, I don't think so.
Okay. Are aircraft flying past, any problem?
Not that I'm aware of, no. I think aircraft actually generally are routed away from here in critical mission times.
Yes.
Launch times, okay, or, for example, when Apollo was landing, aircraft were routed away from where we'd be looking, because they could cause problems. But generally speaking, no, they're not a problem. But critical mission times, like when the spacecraft first comes over the horizon after being launched, you certainly don't want any interference at that time. So yes, they used to do that then.
I noticed that the flights from Sydney to Melbourne and vice versa travel to the south of here. Yeah. And of course most of the planets are to the north.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I think that might be coincidental, but maybe it's not. I'm not privy to that information. I really,
okay.
Yeah. But in answer to your question, I'm certain that we did at critical mission times have dispensation that aircraft would not fly over this area. Yeah.
So at critical mission times, do people who aren't actively involved in the tracking, people, support staff and so on, do they gather around and try to see what's happening?
No, generally speaking, the shift that was on duty would be the shift that was here. Senior management might come in for critical times, but no, the last thing you need is spectators at a time like that. Pretty dedicated bunch of blokes, all pretty expert at what they did. And working as a team, and you just don't need distractions. So in my day anyway, no, that didn't happen.
Yeah, so scenes like we saw in the movie The Dish, where there's a whole bunch of people in the control room, just didn't happen.
No. I was actually at Parkes, and that was a very exaggerated story, and it was done for its comedic value rather than its factual value. It was a very good film, by the way, but it made me cross.
I've spoken to a lot of people who also cross. But
yeah. Not least John Saxon, I think. He was pretty upset about it.
Because some people believe what they see in the movies, don't they?
Well, yeah, unfortunately, that's what made me cross, because I realised that, yeah. Mm. Yeah. But anyway, Rob Sitch was, the guy who produced that movie or directed it, and I'm pretty sure there was a discourse between him and John Saxon.
Well, we must catch up with John sometime about that then.
Yeah, I reckon it'd be worthwhile. Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Keith.
You're very welcome. And thanks for talking to me. I hope I haven't given you any duff gen, as we used to say in the RAF.